First, they need to move from a fixed worldview of humans to a dynamic view. People change. They can change. They can grow. And not see this as an organizational problem, but know that there's a possibility at the individual and collective level to work on this building of capability. And then to move to the third view. So we have fixed, dynamic, and then move to a developmental view, which is instead of just building new skills, which people sometimes will agree can change, but moving so that people can become some of more of who they are, have their essence be expressed, have their will, learn to be self-managing of that. That is where people thrive. And they don't even feel threatened. You don't need to go be in secret to say you changed your mind. They love growing themselves and personally being able to lift themselves up. They don't get stuck then in a static view of themselves or other static view of themselves.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion. Today, we're taking a look at how decision-making is presented in the Harvard Business Review compared to a worldview that is based on regenerative thinking. It may shock you how archaic the HBR ideas really are and what a huge drag they are on innovation and creativity. But first, well, summer's over, and I think I'm already getting the first cold of the season. So, I'm going to be drinking a Rebel Reishi Chocolate Super Herb Elixir to shore up my immunity. Last winter, I had one of these when I started to feel a scratch in my throat, and voila, the cold seemed to pass me right by. Rebel is not only a sponsor of our podcast here at Business Second Opinion, but they create righteous plant alchemy like this, which means it's good for you, your body, your being, and Mother Earth. They also go a step further to co-create a future without human trafficking. Rebel donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale. And through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel." Business Second Opinion is the podcast that digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice, ones you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So, Carol, tell people today what we're going to be paying attention to in this episode.
Well, we've had a couple of questions brought to us about the role of algorithms and what relationship they have and effect they'll have on our decision making. For this podcast, we're not going to look at the algorithm part, but we are going to dig into what we've noticed are several Harvard Business Review, as well as strategy and business articles, which are all about instructing people on decision making. Sometimes they're focused on helping entrepreneurs do that. Some of them are on what centralized versus decentralized decision making looks like, when and where. And sometimes they're on the effects of the projected image we form of people based on how flexible versus confident they are in decision making.
That's a good one. But I noticed that you didn't mention what happens when it comes to the outcomes for the business around how they make decisions and what effect that has on tangible results they get based on how they think when making the decisions. So I like the idea of the topic since it affects all these other subjects you mentioned, including ultimately artificial intelligence, which we'll fully tackle in another episode.
Right. Well, you're making a good point about what they don't pay attention to. The first article I picked up was Harvard Business Review this month, actually September 11th. And it was an article on the value of being able to change your mind on past decisions as new evidence is brought in. The research showed that at a pitch contest, you know, where people are going into investors trying to get money, that those that seemed open to changing their ideas in the engagement with the investors did better in advancing to the next round. And they noticed how some people could and others could not do this quick adaptation. We'll give you the reference to that article in the show notes. So look for episode 134.
So the evidence they put forward is that these entrepreneurs were perceived better by the panel of investors if they demonstrated the ability to reconsider when given new information. In essence, they were seen as more intelligent. Is that the point, or is that always true?
Well, it was the point, but the other thing was that one of the other articles pointed out that Sometimes, under other circumstances, people with sticking to their opinion and being very confident, in fact, overly confident about it, did better and were seen as the more valuable, and in the case of hiring particularly, were seen as the people to hire if they were overconfident, not flexible. And that was also true when they were trying to present ideas to leaders, not in this pitch contest. Those that stuck to their ideas were seen as thoughtful, prepared, and they were more likely to be recommended. So flexibility was not always favored, but was favored a larger percentage of the time. Now listen to this. As a result of this higher percentage favoring it, the researchers set out to teach everyone to be able to change your mind, to be more flexible.
Well, it does appear to be more useful to have that flexibility in mind. So it generally seems like a good idea, though, no?
Well, maybe, but not just for the sake of being flexible, which is what they actually worked on. Not just so you look intelligent. Further, the article in Harvard Business Review and even a second one gave some strange advice, which was to teach people in organizations how to change their mind. It was a big leap, but it was all about how to change your mind, not necessarily rethink. I thought it was crazy.
Wait, what? Okay. So, but what did they suggest?
Just don't laugh, Zach. But they suggested that you arrange it so people could change their mind in private, secretly, so that no one had to face a being identified for fear of looking underconfident or indecisive. They wanted to protect them from the reverse, which was looking stupid. And this was especially true for men and those higher up in their organizations. So they wanted to teach people how to change their mind without worrying about looking bad, as if that was the point of decision making.
You know, Carol, through our work together here, I've developed a pretty strong distaste for fragmenting research on one small idea, like how you're perceived by others in this instance. Especially when it comes to the research that has this focus, not on how to make decisions well, which is the title of the article, but how to look right to other people. And the advice they give people is a way to change your mind in private. That's so great. Like teams working together, as we know, have to make decisions in real time. There has to be an openness and engagement. And this article in the Harvard Business Review, again, gives no reference on how to improve thinking skills beyond being willing to change your mind.
Yeah.
Carol, help me. I might lose it.
Well, it does make you wonder what causes people to come up with these crazy ideas. Beyond that problem, however, with the research, which leads to the narrowing of the study in this behavior, is the fact that this research was done not in real life, like you're talking about, but in a lab and with people who were structured to focus just on this narrow part.
If you read closely, dear listener, you'll realize that what we have here is a paradigm problem. The authors see people as fixed and unchanging without there being an ability to change without pressure from the outside. This is not helping them learn and change. They are stuck in a behavioral paradigm, seeing people as rats in a maze needing to be manipulated.
Yeah, so there is a paradigm problem of this need for external stimulus, which was the basis of all their recommendations, and management being designed to be able to manipulate so that they can respond, i.e. do it in private.
So in a regenerative paradigm, they see the situation as a capability problem that can be improved with the development of capability of people to be more critical in their thinking skills. Here's a quote from Walter Frick in his HBR article on how to improve decision making. Quote, Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winning psychologist, said that overconfidence is the bias he'd eliminate first if he had a magic wand. It's ubiquitous, particularly among men, the wealthy, and even experts. Overconfidence depends on factors including culture and personality, but the chances are good that people are more confident about each step of the decision-making process than they ought to be. Rarely too flexible. I actually find it pretty interesting that Daniel Kahneman, of all people, is focusing on confidence here, when he's most recently quoted in a podcast on Sam Harris saying he doesn't actually use any of his own research for his own benefit, which is really confusing to me. Like, why do you do this research if you're not going to use it?
So what? That's really disconcerting. So what are we going to do? Let's first just start with what they suggested. And again, hold on to your hat. The first suggestion in the article was be less certain with your decisions. Like, Okay, you wave one and you're less certain, which seems easier said than done, even if what you're trying to change to is correct.
So wait, hold on, Carol. So that is only the first problem. The second suggestion is to learn to be good at assessing probabilities so they know in advance how likely their ideas are to work out. That means they have an averaging problem. There are no average situations or people, as the Harvard Mind Brain Research Institute showed in The End of Average. Looking for a likelihood, i.e. the average, is just making the decision-making process abstract. You know, Carol, you'd think since HBR and Mind Brain Institute are both under Harvard, these folks would talk to each other.
Not going to happen. So just to summarize, before we talk about what we think they ought to do, we have three suggestions between these two articles, which are focused on improving decision-making, or so they're called. First, you're supposed to change your mind in private so you can be less embarrassed and less demeaned. Secondly, you should just decide you're always going to be less certain. And then to make obvious and hard to ignore, have them learn about the probabilities process of how likely you are to be right. So none of this, as you pointed out at the beginning, assumes that it's actually a capability opportunity. It's seen as a cultural problem or a math skills problem. The behavioral answer is to change the organization's way of responding or a people's way of assessing the odds of whether their answers are right.
So there must be much better ways that we're going to take a look at now. So what are they missing, Carol? Let's shine a light on that.
All right. First, and we started here, they need to move from a fixed worldview of humans to a dynamic view. People change. They can change. They can grow. And not see this as an organizational problem, but know that there's a possibility at the individual and collective level to work on this building of capability. And then to move to the third view. So we have fixed, dynamic, and then move to a developmental view, which is instead of just building new skills, which people sometimes will agree can change, but moving so that people can become some of more of who they are, have their essence be expressed, have their will, learn to be self-managing of that. That is where people thrive. And they don't even feel threatened. You don't need to go be in secret to say you changed your mind. They love growing themselves and personally being able to lift themselves up. They don't get stuck then in a static view of themselves or other static view of themselves. It not only solves this worry that we have, or the articles seem to have, about paying attention to how one is viewed and how that's interpreted, like overconfidence and whether or not you're actually intelligent or willing to change your mind. But the most amazing thing is actually moving to this developmental level is really good for business.
Yeah, it's funny, Carol. I've seen this in large organizations I worked in for years. The people are evaluated early on in their career and then are assumed to have the same strengths and weaknesses, skills and gaps, and the same level of motivation carried forward from when we first came to know them. It's critical to help people break out of such boxes, and it sounds like a huge challenge. Are there any suggestions on how to get past a mind that sees people as fixed like this?
Yeah, it starts with working with how people think. Not what they do, which is where all these articles are, which, of course, anybody who listens to our podcast is not surprised to hear me say that. But let's take a slightly different perspective than we have before. And I always find going back to something really close to us makes it easier. So you have a son and a daughter, right, Zach?
Yeah, I'm a stepfather who loves them like my own and is legally bound to say that at the same time. So, yes.
So I want to ask you some questions because this is close to you. If I were to ask you to describe what the ideal son looks like at age 15, like what Solomon would look like, first, what are the ideals? And then how does Solomon match up to that? And just watch what happens to you as you go after that kind of answer.
Yeah, so as I'm watching my own mind work, I first think of some shining abstract human that I've seen in movies or read about in books, and they automatically start to pull all these best features and personality characteristics and behaviors into a long list next to them or something like that. Like, this boy always listens to me, and he gets 90% or better on all of his tests, and he always has a clean room, stuff like this. And then when I look at him using that, I see all the ways he achieves some of those things, but more often than not, it's about actually how he falls short of that ideal. It's like he is never going to be enough.
And how does that affect you to go through that kind of thinking?
I realize now that I see this, that this is all about what I want rather than who he's becoming and what drives him. It's about me forcing him into being something rather than me understanding who he's becoming. It feels rigid, actually, in my whole body, which is weird.
Yeah, right. So this is what I call doing model thinking. So you go look for the model, right? I hate the term role model because it's just like this, same kind of thinking. And as you say, you're comparing him in some generic way to some far-off ideal or prototype. So let me just ask you a couple other questions here. We don't tend to see our children in models except when we're upset with them. But let's compare that now to framework thinking. Framework thinking calls on us to discover what's unique, what's exciting about Solomon, and how he's taking on the world. What does this portend for him to have this uniqueness? What potential does he have to develop and serve his own aspirations? And how might your role change if you're thinking about him this way?
Yeah, that's a lot all at once, but I'll see if I can kind of string these together a little bit as I'm thinking about this. So Solo, I'm thinking back to actually to when we were camping this summer. He's always been really good in a crisis, right? Like something goes off the rails and he's right there, totally engaged and prepared. It's like his pace doesn't quicken or anything. He's just on point. So I don't know what that portends for him necessarily, but I can see him using that almost like a superpower to help and care for people, regardless of the industry. So when I think about him, it's really about him sharpening this capacity and developing that potential into a capability of some kind. It's like I have a flavor of it, but I can't quite articulate it. And it's funny, as I said, we just had this very conversation this summer while we were camping, actually, because I was so blown away by it. So I think I need to continue to be a resource for him as he explores using this in the world.
Now, as you watch you describe that compared to the model when you get out of the movies, and what you're doing is shifting from a model way of thinking, comparing him to a framework way of thinking, which is more open and exploratory. How does it affect your state of being? And what does it do to your will to move more toward working with Solomon in a particular way?
Well, I feel more open and more caring towards him and who he is and who he's trying to become, and less harsh, right? I'm not trying to like push something on him. And it's more about, yeah, I feel in an abstract way lined up alongside him rather than being against him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it really does. So what would you say, just from your own experience just now, the characteristics are of model thinking versus framework thinking?
Yeah, well, models are generic and are abstracted from the real and meaningful, right? It's like, you're supposed to be this way is the kind of, and I'm using my hand to like push something down on top of somebody. It's like they tell me the answers ahead of time, which goes back to our previous podcast about questions or answers. So framework thinking explores a specific understanding of each being, and then I can extend that into each place, customer, or even raw material. So it actually builds my capabilities as well.
Yeah. And the amazing thing about this is also true, not just in a sense with a father-child or stepfather-child, but think about what would happen if you have every person in your company who looks at the place that you touch and the customers that you work with and even raw materials and is looking at them from framework thinking versus some generic best practice. How do you end up feeling, because you've got a company, right? And how does it shift your relationship when you're working with these entities in a more framework thinking way rather than a model way thinking way?
So I feel more motivated about being in some kind of relationship with them, right? And being in a business relationship with them. And I feel like I'm pulled less out of the day-to-day grind of battling and being in fear around my business, and more about just desperately trying to understand how to support my clients while we grow the business in partnership and some kind of relationship together. That's what's clear for me.
Yeah. And people are probably sitting there listening and realizing, wait, this happens in my organization. We use model thinking in almost every situation. It is the default. So to be able to switch to using framework thinking and stop using model thinking, because you have to actively work on both. You can't say, well, we'll do some framework thinking and we'll do some model thinking, because it's actually framing a mind of the way you see the world. So you have to switch the mind so it knows to turn on framework thinking and turn off model thinking, because the models give you answers that are always average, they're always generic, they're always idealized, Whereas frameworks are giving you questions like the ones I'm asking you. They come out of a framework and they provide arenas in which you can form a way of thinking more critically and develop questions to guide you in each unique situation.
So framework thinking is actually specific to a real situation with names attached to it. Persons, places, buyers, suppliers, like Solomon, my stepson, or a customer like, I don't know, Rexall drugstores, or a supplier like Microsoft. And each has aspirations and intentions to create great things in the world. And they have a uniqueness and distinctiveness we need to understand and engage with. Framework thinking offers living structures without answers already predetermined. And it invites us to see beings as alive and on a specific journey they're inviting us to support them in. But we cannot see that if we have a model in our head and are fixed on the gap between the model and the real thinking.
And it, I think, becomes easier now to look at these articles, which are recommended, those in HBR I'm talking about, are composed of models. In fact, Harvard Business Review mostly is composed of people offering you a model with the answers, as here, where the challenge was for people looking overconfident or inflexible stem from the same problem, a paradigm problem, as you said, a fixed view of how they are judged by someone thinking about them through a model, and likely judging themselves through the same kind of models. And neither have anything to do with getting better workable answers for the people in the organization and the organization itself. In fact, each compensation method that's being recommended in the article, whether you're standing firm in your answer or bending with the people who might give you dollars and coming to have this idealized model in their head and you're trying to figure out how to adapt to it, well, the real challenge here is people can't see that a model is driving them. It's affecting all of their thinking, what they take into account, the weight that's given to what they're thinking about. And the models tell you the predetermined set of answers, and you get stuck with them as the only ones allowed or as the best practices. It sets people off toward kind of over-defending a position and cannot see that others have a different model that they think is right and they're defending.
Using framework thinking is working with graphic structures that show the arenas or domains to consider and form questions unique to a situation. It avoids the generic answers problem, as well as the idea of a template that fits anywhere. It also provides a shared and organized way to think about something, and not a set of predetermined answers. This is what we teach people to do with the Carol Sanford Institute.
Yes. All our communities are built on being able to have this worldview, to activate it in ourselves, and see them rather than as flat, static, fixed things, to see them as alive. We have communities now which might interest people, as we were just doing with looking at Solomon, on how to apply this work to parenting, how to apply it and work with women entrepreneurs, a whole separate community just for women who are running campaigns or not-for-profits or their small business. And soon we will have many more based on my new book I just sent to the editor, Nicholas Breeley, called The Regenerative Life. So, for example, in an organization, a model might suggest that we look for high, medium, and low performers. But the very nature of a model means that's what we end up seeing. We can't actually do the evaluation and the engagement and the development that lets us see people as different, unique, just like we were doing with Solomon. So a framework structures arenas to consider things in. Do we want to be a powerful person to evaluate people? Or do we want self-evaluation, people being able to look at themselves in a whole and complete way? What are the implications of those choices? What would each promote in organizational behavior and outcomes? There are only arenas in a framework, and therefore exploring, and anyone and everyone can continuously be changing their mind, not so that they look brilliant, but because it clearly makes sense in a dialogue that is carried forward. And if we're applying to a business, what are we suggesting, Zach, about that?
I think the bottom line here, Carol, is that this is about moving the entire organization from static to dynamic through ongoing development in all meetings and group work, using reflection processes. These are intended to give people the capacity to see the world as dynamic and not static, and to see themselves in the same way. But this is a simple and yet massive change for most existing businesses and education cultures.
So I'd like to give people one little tip. This is one that anybody can do immediately. It starts moving the mind from fixed to dynamic and then to developmental, as well as it really begins to look at how framework thinking works. If you think about most evaluation, the way we do it, we say what's good, bad, right and wrong, works, doesn't work, any number of polarities you can think of. Instead, what you want to ask in every group evaluation or even personal evaluation for yourself now is, all right, we're moving towards something. The question is, as I look at it right now, how much have I moved toward it in the last, pick a period, week, month, wherever you're stopping evaluating? And then secondly, what's the work to do next? So you notice I'm never polarizing it. Anything that we normally would have said didn't work is only the work to do next. So begin to leave every meeting with stopping and saying, how did we advance our strategy, for example, in this meeting? And what work do we still need to do next? If it's looking at a person, you say, where has that person grown? And where is their opportunity to grow next? And mostly you want them asking that question. It's a very simple tip to switch how you do evaluation and reflection.
And second, give people education and practice and framework and shared processes to develop ideas that is not brainstorming, which we've talked about before. Move from model thinking to framework thinking. Models have definite answers and individual answers. Frameworks are about questions and arenas for questioning to see how the relationships work among various entities and processes and how they change. If people want to see more about these principles and stories about how they get carried out, check out our new offerings for the Regenerative Women Entrepreneur and the Regenerative Parent at seedcommunities.com. That's SEED-communities.com. Look at the Regenerative Life Communities on the navbar. And be sure to read No More Feedback, which has another set of stories building the capability of people to work with framework thinking and achieve the ability to do this while getting rid of model thinking and the resulting view of the world as fixed.
And for today's session, I want to thank Yeshua, one of the change agent members out of San Francisco, because he asked me a long time ago to work on helping him think more about how regenerative decision-making works. So we're giving you a second opinion mug that can hold your favorite hot or cold beverage. And if you'd like to see what this looks like, you can check out our webpage on Business Second Opinion. There's a picture there. And if you want to get one of those mugs, then you need to send us topics on practices in business on which you feel like there is a need for a second opinion. You can send questions that you have and want us to consider to carol@businesssecondopinion.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at biz_second_opinion. And if we use your question to develop an episode, you get a mug. And may I also ask you to do your ratings reviews on any platform you follow so that people can find us, because it does raise where we show up on searches and help spread the word. And sign up for our newsletter so that you know about when our show notes come out, when these are posted. Join us everywhere.
And thanks as always to Numi Tea. They sponsor our show notes and are a local champion for the upcoming Regenerative Business Summit, November 19th. Check out Business Second Opinion website, where you can learn more about how your essence can become a powerful decision-making guide to grow your business. And join Numi Tea as a champion in your own town. Go to theRegenerativeBusinessSummit.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.